Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish the book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for you people to download and listen to at anywhere you want. It seems like lots and lots of people enjoyed the review that I did in the last episode of Slaughterhouse-5 by Kurt Vonnegut. Literally within 2 days, I got maybe 15 emails and messages, loads of everyone just like, oh, really good fun, thanks a lot for that. Mainly lots of people who enjoyed the book were really pleased that I also enjoyed the book and rated it so well and went into so much depth about it. And then those other people, the people who I called an idiot for not understanding the book, some of them, like three people who actually didn't understand the book, they enjoyed the book but they didn't understand it at the level that I called them an idiot for not understanding. They were actually really pleased that I had gone into so much spoilerific depth into the book and explained what they were missing as well. So I'm thinking maybe I'll do that in a future, because it was a way, because normally I get lots of good reactions about when I do negative reviews and have a good rant now and then about a book, but I actually really enjoy doing good reviews of books that I really love and are passionate about, whereas this time with Slaughterhouse-5 I could do a passionately good review and then still rant at other people's reviews of it, which is a bit, maybe one way of doing reviews, keeping reviews interesting and fresh. But it was really nice to get so much feedback. Thanks a lot for everyone. Hopefully I replied to everyone's emails and messages, but if not, or if you got anything else to say, email me luke@juggler.net. so other news going on at the moment. NaNoWriMo, it's November. I'm writing a novel, the third part of my Minding Tomorrow trilogy, which has become sort of my NaNoWriMo novel project over these last 3 Novembers. It's going really well. I'm up to about, 25,000 words or something like that. I didn't write yesterday. I mean, I didn't write at the weekend because I was at a juggling convention and hanging out with my girlfriend, but I managed to catch up. In 3 days, I wrote about 12,000 words and still going strong. Even though I didn't write yesterday, I had to do my show yesterday evening, so I was concentrating mainly yesterday on visiting Corsica, my first time to Corsica, and then doing my show in the evening. And my first show, actually, I had more fun on stage than I've had on stage for a long time, for maybe 6 months or so. And I thought, wow, that was really good fun, and I got loads of good reactions from the audience. And then in my second show, I had even more fun on stage, because the first show went a little bit long. And then the second show, the cruise director, who's my boss, he says, hey, Luke, just take you can take as long as you want in this show, because there's nothing happening after it. And I think he was just saying that because he was being sarcastic about how long I went in the first show. But I just went, okay. So I just did whatever I want, improvised loads on stage, and did an extra 15 minutes more than I was meant to. I meant to do a 50-minute show, and in the end, I did 1 hour and 5 minutes. On stage, got 2 standing ovations, one part of the way through the show, and then one a big one at the end, and yeah, it's pretty much one of my favorite ever shows, and that was just last night. So I was like, way, go for it. Anyway, what was I saying? Yeah, NaNoWriMo, I'll get to it writing today. Anyway, the ship that I'm on missed a port today. We're meant to be going to Sardinia, but the weather didn't work out. Actually, it's really nice weather out there now, but the wind was blowing too strong in the wrong direction or something like that, which meant that we couldn't use the tenders, which are the small boats that you use to get backwards and forwards from the cruise ship into port if the port isn't big enough to take the cruise ship. I've sort of got ships on the mind after reading this book that I'm going to be reviewing today. But so because this port was missed and I've got a day at sea, which was a little bit unexpected, I thought I would not start writing my own novel straight away. I thought I'd wade through to the end of the book flood. See what I did there? That was a pun. Wade through the end of the book flood and get this review uploaded and stuff before I head home from Barcelona tomorrow. Actually, I just made that pun. I think I'm going to see if I can avoid puns about water and flood and the sea rises and stuff as I do this, because this is the kind of thing that I notice on the I noticed this before, and like the Amazon 1-star reviews always said, oh, I was drowning in this book, or I wanted to drown this book, or these are just ones off the top of my head, but I'm sure people have made I had to wade through this book kind of pun on Amazon.com pithy 1-star reviews. I'm going to see if I can avoid them. Anyway, so Flood by Stephen Baxter, 2008 it came out, 536 pages long, according to Goodreads.com. Worked out about 15 hours as an audiobook. I listened to it as an Audible Frontiers audiobook. Actually, it took me a lot less time than that, because I always listen to books like this at two times speed, because, you know, some books you want to listen to and really ponder and really enjoy, but some you just want to stick on two times speed, even though I don't think it actually works two times speed. You know, judging by my own calculations, I think it's like more 1.5 or 1.6 times speed, judging by the amount of time it takes to get through the audiobooks. Anyway, so I thought I'd read this because I like science fiction and big ideas, and I quite like Stephen Baxter's writing. He normally does quite well with, you know, hard science fiction stuff. And I have it, The Time Ships by Stephen Baxter, which is a follow-up to The Time Machine. But it's a paper book, and I couldn't be bothered to take it with me on this trip, but I wanted some stuff to read, so I thought I'd spend an Audible credit on a Stephen Baxter book. But no, I didn't want to waste the audio credit on a book that I already have in paper form, like the Time Ship, so I thought I would get... I thought I'd splash out and buy Flood as well. So, so what is Flood? Flood is a disaster... book... just thought of another pun. I'll save that until the end of my review. So it's a disaster book where there's lots of floods. There's big floods. And it's not to do with global warming, although you think the start of the book could be about global warming in a way, but it isn't about that. So here's my way that I'm going to do this setup. You've seen the movie Waterworld, and you go, well, like, there's lots of water, and I think, you know, spoilerific here for the end of Waterworld, there is a little bit of land on Waterworld, but there's not very much of it, you know, probably some of just the little bits of the tops of the Himalayas or something like that, and that's the quest. They're going, they want to find dry land, that's what they want to do and stuff like that. But, you know, because there's a big question, it's like, okay, where did all the water come from? That is the, that is, well, it's not the main bad thing about the film. I think there's many other reasons why that movie is dull and why nobody cared about it so much. Actually, the reason why most people didn't care about, hey, where did all the water come from, is because it was flawed in many other ways and stuff like that. Because if all the ice melts on Earth, you know, all the ice caps melt, so, yeah, the water raises, what, 80, 90 meters or something like that? That's what, you know, that's what the boffins have worked out. So, with Waterworld, I always thought, because I'm a science fiction fan, I was always like, okay, how did all this water come here and where did it all come from? And I was trying to think of sort of like some kind of, you know, quote unquote, hard science reason why the Earth would be flooded. Because it's definitely Earth. It's not Waterworld. It's not like a different world, because at one point they actually go down and see the drowned cities underwater and they have jet skis and things like that. So it's definitely Earth. And I always thought, well, how about the Earth passes through like a big cloud of comets somehow, or maybe, you know, something that's disturbed out in the Oort cloud, and all these comets come in, and they but they're small comets, which means that when they hit the Earth, they break up in the atmosphere, but all of the water inside the comets, you know, maybe they're really like got this really light consistency or something. I don't know how it would work. But then as it comes through the atmosphere, all of the water gets absorbed in the atmosphere and then rains out into the seas. I mean, you'd need a lot of this water, but apparently, I think there's quite a lot of water out there in space. So that's what it must have come from. But of course, you know, Waterworld is over in about 2 hours, so you don't really think about that too much. So anyway, Flood by Stephen Baxter is pretty much the setup to Waterworld. It's like, okay, so you've seen the movie Waterworld. What is the prequel? Flood is the prequel to Waterworld, although it turns out Flood is also a prequel to Ark, the next book in the series. I'll talk about that later as well. But he has a different hard science explanation from where the water comes from. And it turns out, and again, this isn't really giving too much away, because even though this is the main thrust of the book, this is the main... part of the book that you sort of, you know, the premise of the book, if you will, it's like it's discarded. It's like people go, you know, there's a scientist who goes, yes, I've got this information, I've worked out this theory. What's the theory? Oh, let me take you on a subramine ride, and then I'll tell you the theory in this really interesting place down at the bottom of the sea, and we'll explain it, you know, and sort of like that. It's like, no, just tell me the theory. No, I'm not going to tell you the theory. I'm going to hold it off, because I have to hold it off until the quarter way mark of the book, because that's when you've got to explain what the main theory is of disaster. And I'm like, oh, is it really? Yeah, you've got to leave it until the quarter mark. Even though I know it now, I'm going to hold off this theory. Anyway, so that's what happens, and it turns out that water is bubbling up from underneath the crust, and so yeah, that's it. Now, a little bit of water coming bubbling up from underneath the crust would be quite interesting. Now, if it was like a flood and it's like, oh, the global ice caps are, you know, melting, and the scientists are going, well, are they really, you know, and all the deniers are going, oh no, it's not, and then suddenly water bubbles up from the ground and there's a, you know, there's a sudden, you know, 1 meter over the course of a year, suddenly the sea level rises, something like that, and the ice hasn't melted and stuff like that. You know, it could have been something like that, but it isn't. It's not just 1 meter, it's 1 meter, and then another meter, and then another meter, until, of course, even at the end of the book, I'm not giving much away here, but, you know, at the end of the book, there's no land left at all, like, which means, how high is Everest? Like, 8,000 and, no, it's like just under 8,000, say 8,800 meters or something, however high Everest is. Oh, no, I think, actually, Everest is exactly 8,800 meters tall by the first measurement, but when they reported it, the Indian mapping expedition led by actually someone called Everest, which Mount Everest is named after, but it's incorrectly pronounced by everyone, by the way. It was actually exactly 8,800 meters. But what they did, they reported it as 8,801 meters because he said, "Oh, if I just said 8,800 meters, everyone will think we're just rounding up." And we don't want them to round. We don't want them to think that we're just rounding off the height of this mountain just to be the highest mountain in the world at roughly 8,800 meters. If we say 8,801 meters, you know, so let's just say 8,800 meters, which is a lot of water to come out of the ground. Now, water. This is my big problem here with this main premise of the whole book, is that water has to come from somewhere, and if it's under the ground, it's quite dense, so it has to be stored somewhere. So when it comes out of the ground and is now above the ground, you know, there's no cause for this. There's no way that there should be any reason that water that's under the ground, because, you know, say, water's quite heavy. So if it comes out of the ground, the only thing that can make it come out of the ground, if that there's a weight pressing down on it to create pressure, which is enough pressure to force the water out of the ground. Which means that if there's pressure going down and the water comes out, gravity must be causing that pressure, so that means the ground must fall. Like, so if the water rises 8,000 meters globally, it means that there must have been enough water under the ground to, let me put it this way, the ground must drop 8,000 meters vertically to be able to bring the water up above it. I mean, this is like, it. You know, Archimedes sitting in a bath, he sits in the bath, he shouts, "Eureka!" You know, displacement and all of that like that. If water is coming up, the ground must go down. It's in the same way that when, like, something, you drop something into water, the water rises, the displacement is of the same volume. I mean, literally, I'm going back to the foundations of science, like one of the first recorded experiments that had ever been done. You know, that the reason why we say Eureka is because this is the experiment which the scientist says Eureka about. And Baxter seems to have just completely ignored this. Okay, so the water is rising up, but the land isn't sinking, strangely. So there's not these massive... it says, oh, there's some earthquakes here, and the world is settling out. But it's never, oh, the world is settling out because there's suddenly 8,000 meters worth of hole underneath the entire surface of the earth, which, in a way, is a bit strange. So if it did, it would have to crumple in and, like, you know, concertina. It would be like corrugated cardboard or something like that, where as the world actually shrinks and as the water comes over the top... But it's never talked about that way. It's always like, oh yeah, just imagine there's lots of ice, you know, and then the ice melts and the because this is what's happening in lots of places, you know, after the major glaciation of the last major ice age, the weight of the ice leaving the world rebounds, and then there's more ice being loaded on top of the earth, like down in Antarctica, actually the sea level, I mean, let me put it this way, the bottom of the ice is way, 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 way below the mean sea level in Antarctica. You're like, the ice goes all the way down, you know, the weight of the ice keeps pressing it down as well, and presses down, you know, volcanoes under Antarctica are being sealed shut by the weight and things. And that kind of weight of the water above the earth is talked about. But the whole point of this book is that, well, let me put it this way. The Earth's crust must drop 8,000 meters. There's nothing coming out of the Earth to replace the water because the Earth has got like this set mass. Something has to come from outside to be able to... Anyway, so massive big problem here with the book. Now, it is possible to have a good disaster book based on a single idea. I mean, it's very possible to have any book based on a single idea and be good, even if there's just a single idea. However, this book is pretty much based on this single idea, a big global flood. But then the basis of the idea is stupid. It's like I don't know anything. I know very little about science. What I know about science pretty much comes from science fiction books and popular science books. And Stephen Baxter, I'm pretty sure I opened his Wikipedia page here. I didn't look at it very much, but I'm pretty sure he's like some Yeah, he has degrees in mathematics and engineering. Oh, okay, so maybe he doesn't do geography and that kind of science and stuff like that. But yeah, you would think that he'd be able to crunch the numbers and work out, or, you know, at least know what gravity, at least know what displacement is. Anyway, so I thought, well, what I'll do, I'll just ignore that, and then I'll just have fun with the book. The Earth is flooding. But then he throws in this other thing, is that, like, the flooding starts off a meter here and then 2 meters here and then but then it turns out that it's an exponential rise, and the rate of the rising sea doubles every 5 years. Now, no explanation of this is given either. It's like, okay, so if there's, again, it's weird. It's just like, oh yeah, there's these great underground vast, you know, bits of water, which, you know, it comes out. Now, like, if there's a good reason why there's this exponential, rather than just plot reason, it'd be really nice to know. Like, my idea of going through a comet cloud and lots of water coming down, you go into the edge of the cloud is really sparse, you know, like the whole solar system is going through it, and like the sun is being bombarded and, you know, with all this water, and it's fizzling up, and all the other planets are being bombarded with it as well. But Earth is working out somehow. I don't know how it would work. But, you know, Earth is getting all this water, and you're in the edge of the cloud, there's not many of the comets. And as you go further and further in, it keeps raining, and the rain gets worse and worse and worse and more and more and more of it. Now, that would work for an exponential rise, and then it maybe drop off on the other side, so it keeps going through. So maybe that would be a better way of telling this story, is if you are going through this comet cloud, because it needs to be water, not rock. So that would work out, because then you could sort of like have water rising, quicker and quicker and quicker, and then it'll tail off. And then in the end, you can have water world, which means the tops of the world. But even in this book, it never says, like, it keeps rising exponentially, but there's never any slack off. So what's going to happen? Is there even more water down there that's still going to come out? I mean, of course, at the end, there's no more land, and maybe at that point, it doesn't matter how high or how much higher the water rises, and, you know, because there's not even a point of reference anymore. Nobody cares anymore. But, yeah, really strange. So, anyway, bringing on to the story. That's not the story. That's just the setup, which is you can explain in the amount of time I've just explained it. I've just taken, 10 minutes to talk about the setup to the story. But, like, you could write a fun short story saying, oh, yeah, there's lots of water under the ground, and then the water rises and stuff like that. So we have to have a story. So we start off with these five people who are hostages, and they've been kept in a cellar. It never really explained why they're hostages. They're like mismatched people. Group of people. There's an army officer and our main character, who is like a helicopter pilot for the US. She's British, but she's a US Navy. Oh, maybe she's in. No, I can't remember what she's in. Anyway, she's a US Air Force helicopter pilot. And you've got this scientist who just happens to be, you know, a climatologist, kind of, you know, earth science kind of scientist. And two other characters. One is, I think she's a tourist or something, and she has been raped in the 5 years that they've all been held hostage, and has a baby, a rape baby. Anyway, so what you do is you have five people locked away in the world, and it'd be really good. Like, you know, and as the beginning of it starts, they're like, oh, they're being kept in a cellar, and the cellar is flooded in Barcelona and things. You're like, oh, okay, that's a great idea. And it starts off, they take these people out, and they're like, wow, what's changed in the world in these last 5 years that we've been locked away? And everyone's going, oh, there's all this flooding. Oh, there's all this kind of stuff, which works. You know, it's some real drama there. You've got the hostage, you know, rescue, and they get taken to London, and the guy who's managed to spring them, who's managed to rescue them, is a guy called Nathan Lennoxon, who's a billionaire, who's like, oh yeah, I just rescued you, I sent in my troops, you know, just for publicity, but now, you know, you guys are really good for me, and I'm gonna keep you together. And they're all like, yeah, we're gonna stick together, oh yeah, and we're gonna get, oh yeah, and of course, this baby called Grace, she's taken away at the beginning because she's the daughter of a Saudi prince or something like that, who raped them in captivity. Yeah, it's a bit weird. So they've all been, it's a bit of a strange thing, but they're all like, yeah, let's all stick together and let's get Grace back. And, you know, Nathan Lannigan's like, yeah, let's get Grace back. Uh-oh, London's flooding. And so you get this quite long section about London flooding. It's quite detailed, quite exciting. I mean, it's a lot of listing of places. Oh, and this street gets flooded, and this part of London gets flooded, and this part, you know. But there's people flying with, you know, helicopters to rescue family members, and, you know, you get this surge that overwhelms the Thames Barrier. Quite interesting and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be cool. And then we skip forward, like, a few years, or a year or something. And then I'm like, wait a second, isn't the point of having an ignorant group of people who've been, you know, taken away out of society for 5 years, is that they can experience everything for real and stuff like that? You know, they can have things explained to them. It's like the scientist guy who can go up and say, hey, what's happening here? And, you know, Gary, the scientist, and, you know, in his old acquaintance, scientist acquaintance, is like, hey, I've been working on this theory, and now let me explain this theory to you. And he's like, oh, great, because I've been away for 5 years, so it's really handy for you to to explain this. And someone else can go, hey, I'm going to go and visit my sister in London. And when they get there, they're like, hey, what's it like here in London? So, oh, the flooding is here is really bad. Look, we've had to redecorate because of the flooding. And all that kind of idea is great, because you, like, put, you know, a group of people who are inexperienced with the situation, and because this is a worldwide phenomenon, they have to be locked away, like prisoners and things like that, for a long time. So... There's different ways to do that. It's like in the book Earth Abides, the guy goes out into the country and then he comes back and experiences the plague that's killed off everyone for the first time. He just, you know, he's been a bit ill, and then when he comes back to it, you know, it's a great way of looking, you know, looking at a new, like a disaster in this way. But we skip forward, and so that whole dynamic, that whole interesting part of being able to explain things to ignorant people, is just go away. So then what he does, he goes, okay, so then we've done this, and what's happened in the last year? Oh, okay, then we're going to do this. Right, now we're going to flood New York, and we've got this New York flooding, which is, you know, a little bit more interesting, because it's a little bit bigger of a flood, and we would take this big long walk through New York. And that's someone who's just spent 4 weeks in New York in September. It was quite interesting, because the walk down, like, downtown that they do, like, they land in Central Park and then walk downtown. One of my projects, or one of the things that I did in New York, was actually I walked down the entire length of Manhattan on Broadway, and I sort of, by doing that, by walking through New York, you really get, you know, a feel for the high points, and you walk up the hill and then down a hill and then up more hills and down hills. You know, Manhattan is actually quite a hilly place, and I was cycling around as well quite a lot. When you just cycle north to south, you get that quite a bit, but then when you go up to, say, around about, you know, 35th Street or something like that, and cycle east to west, you realize that there's quite a lot of hills, you know, around that kind of area. It goes up and down quite a lot. So that was quite interesting, that thing. And then there's this hurricane. Was it a cyclone is in the Indian Ocean, a typhoon is in the Pacific, and a hurricane is in the Atlantic. I think they're all exactly the same thing, but, like, you know, the different oceans have different names for them. So a hurricane comes in, whoosh, blows through and stuff like that. So, it's okay. But then you skip forward a bit more, and I'm just like, wait a second, all we're doing is we're skipping forward, and then someone will die, and then someone will do this, and then, and then I realize, oh, this book is telling the story of the entire 35, 40 years it takes for the sea level to first flood London and then to flood the tops of the Himalayas. And it just keeps skipping forward and forward. And at the beginning, it starts at one pace. It's like, disaster, London is flooded. And I'm like, way. And then New York is flooded, yay. And then you're like, and now this city is flooding. And you're like, yeah. And then another city is flooding. Okay. And in the end, it just, because he can't list all of the floods in details, in the amount of, like, hey, we're there on the ground, we have to be rescued by helicopters all the time. And he's like, okay, like, what do we do in this situation? Oh, another helicopter rescue. And what about now? Oh, helicopter rescue. Oh, what now? Helicopter rescue. What now? Supermarine rescue. What now? Helicopter rescue. Yeah, it's a little bit like that throughout it. But, you know, instead of doing that, he's just like, oh, yes, they looked at the data. Oh, today's the day that this city has been flooded. Oh, and today's the day that the last city in Australia is flooded. And today's the day that the last city in Spain is flooded. And today's the, you know, and now Denver is flooded. And it keeps going on like that and skipping forward and forward. So in some ways, the story is exciting at the beginning because it's quite quick and there's lots of action. And then as it goes through, the story or the action slows down, but then the actual pace of the story and time passing speeds up. So in some ways, the story feels slow, and in other ways, the story feels too quick. I'm just like, no, so we slow down a bit, because it would be really great to get a little bit more detail here. So, and like I say, a lot of just stuff happens, and there's this person, that person dies, and that person gets shot, and this person dies, and then this city gets flooded, and so and the main characters, these group of hostages, at the beginning they all get split up, and then they come back together, and they get split up and come back together. This person meanders off that way and then comes back here, and this person meanders off that way and then comes back here, and then they meet up again here and they get split up. And it really reminded me a bit of the in this way, it's sort of like, I remember saying this about the book, Ice and Fire. The Game of Thrones by George R. R. Martin. And I was saying, like, any one point in the book, you know, like I say, I said this to in a podcast, I can't remember who I was talking to, and I said, at any point in the book, tell me what any one of the main characters is actually working for at that point. And you're just like, well, at the beginning of the book, this character wants this, but then by the end of the book, they want this, and it changes, you know, and all the way through, the characters are wanting different things at all the times. And in this book, it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go here. And then, it, like a few chapters later, we read that they have got there. And then a few chapters later, they're somewhere else. It's like, oh yeah, I didn't want to be down there. Actually, I wanted to be up here. It's like, wait a second, you walked across two continents to get to that place. And then the next time we meet you, you're back at the place that you started again. It's like, why did you go down? I mean, of course the flood's going up, but nobody goes, right, this is my plan for the flood, and I'm going to do this. And then we find out over the course of the book that they did that or not. Because all that happens is you just go, oh, okay, so I want to be in this. The flood is coming up, so everyone should go to England. And they're like, no, no, wait a second, Iceland. Iceland is much better because it's a bit more, you know, out of the... No, 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 let's go to Denver. No, no, Peru. No, no, Tibet. You know, and they just keep going, oh, no, we don't want to be there. We want to be here. Oh, no, we don't want to be there. We want to be here. And in the same way that the Game of Thrones... is like just characters just meeting up and splitting up and meeting up and just wandering around. It's like, we're going to go east. Oh, no, no, no. No, we're going to go west. And I don't just want a line A, B, C, D, E kind of story going on. But it's really difficult when, like, stuff is just happening and encounters between characters is just happening. And sometimes at random, sometimes they plan to meet up, and then other times it's a bit more random, and this character will die, and then someone else will be born. And then this other, like, even right near the end of the book, new characters are being introduced, and they're telling their stories and things. It's like, I don't really need all that kind of stuff. Now, there are some good moments in the books, which are good. I don't want to go into them here, because they're a spoiler. But there's other stuff, which I think, wait a second, he's just been reading other books here. At one point, they say, oh yeah, when the floods came into Australia, there were some people, surfers, were trying to ride the waves in. And that was really stupid of them, wasn't it? You know, some characters are idiots trying to ride in these, you know, tidal waves coming in. And I'm like, wait a second, in Lucifer's Hammer, that was one of my favourite parts of that book, where the surfer catches the tidal wave from the asteroid strike out to sea. It's really good fun. It's like, don't say that this other disaster book, you know, that one of the best scenes in another disaster book is really dumb, like when someone does it in your book, like, because A, it sounds like you're ripping that person off, and B, nothing in this book was as good as in, like, none of your cool scenes were, actually, no, I mean, like, a lot of the writing is at the same or the same style of disaster movie as Lucifer's Hammers, but Lucifer's Hammers is way better than this book as well. And also he goes, hey, we're going to build this nuclear power station, and it's going to be a locus for future humanity. And I was like, wait a second, that's like a line almost word for word from Lucifer's Hammer, isn't it? Yeah. And at the end, there was these, like, what's happening at the end, there's this certain, you know, these children are sort of giving up almost on the memories of the past and the next generation. The people are saying, oh, isn't it bad that the next generation aren't going to, you know, keep our, you know, history alive and not going to keep our knowledge alive. And I was like, wait a second, isn't this exactly the same as Earth Abides? You know, like, one of the reasons. And then one of the characters saying, oh, yes, this generation passes away. And then this generation, all things will pass away. But Earth abideth. It's from Ecclesiastes, you know. And I'm like, that's where Earth Abides got its name, and it's a way better book than this. You know, it's a bit strange that you're reading this book. It's like, you can't just repeat the titles and the events of other books, of other great disaster books, of other great post-apocalyptic books, and even just repeat the themes without adding anything new to them. You know, I don't want to go into too much about the themes of this book, but it's a bit strange he was nodding, like, to these other books. Anyway, what else have I got a note here? Global disaster novels. Ah, yeah. Oh, maybe this will be another 15-minute rant. But here we go. Let me just take my jacket off because I'm getting a bit warm. I need a drink here. For some reason, it's something got really warm in my room. I'm not editing that bit out, by the way. So, big problem, what I've got with this kind of story. Global disaster novel. Now, a good way to do a disaster novel, which I always do in movies and stuff, they don't go, right, we're going to look at the entire world. We're going to look at the entire scope of it. Well, they do, but they do it in films like... you know, the big disaster ones like The Day After Tomorrow and 2012. I've not seen 2012, but it's that kind of thing that go, oh, we're going to go here, we're going to go there, and we're going to see it from this direction, that direction, and this direction, and that direction. It's like at the beginning of... can't remember the name. Armageddon, of course, yeah. They go, right, we're going to bomb New York, and then we're going to bomb part of Japan, and then we're going to bomb over here, not bomb, you know, drop asteroids on here and here and here. And it shows, like, the worldwide kind of struggle to it. But the kind of disaster that you know, you have in Armageddon, it's really only NASA who can do anything about it, and they team up with the Russians, and they go off and try and solve the thing. And it's the same again with the other comet Comet One, Deep Impact. It's really only one group. So you tell the story through a small group of people who are actually doing something about it. Or, like in other disaster movies, it doesn't matter. It's a worldwide disaster, but we're not going to concentrate on the whole world. We're going to concentrate on this one little group. You know, in the volcano movies, you know, like Dante's Peak, they're not going to go, right, we're going to do the whole, like everyone, we're not going to tell everyone's story about this whole world. We're going to just go, right, we're going to get this one family and we're going to tell their story. And it doesn't matter what's happening to all these other people. We're going to tell the story of how this family is going to survive and who's going to survive and stuff like that. But what we have here is that we've got this entire world, and it covers the entire world. Literally, people go to every continent, or maybe not, maybe Australia and Antarctica aren't visited, but pretty much everywhere else in the entire world is visited at one point. And we get the stories, oh, in this country they're doing this, and in this country they're doing this, in this country they're doing this, in this country. Now, this is okay if, as a writer, you're as clever as the entire population of the world now. Because really, at the moment, if, like, there is a global disaster of all this flooding, anyone can do anything to a certain extent. Well, not anything, but, you know, like, anybody can come up with loads of different ideas. And the book lasts 36 years as well, or 35. Or I worked, maybe it's 36 years, I can't remember. It was 52 or something when the last world is covered, and it starts in 60. Yeah, say, let's say 36 years. So I worked that out as I was reading the book, but I couldn't. Wasn't sure if I got it right. So in 36 years, you've got to, and like this is, again, it's not just sort of a global disaster happening right now and you've got to work out in the next week what everyone's going to do. No, you've got 36 years of the entire population of the world and how they deal with something. They're going to come up with lots of really good ideas, lots of really clever ideas, lots of really novel ideas of how to survive flooding. Or, to put it another way, you don't have to, you know, be as clever as the entire population of the world, but at least be as clever as the entire population of people who are going to read your books, because you've got to think of their ideas. Now, for example, at one point he mentions, you know, genetic modified seaweed, which clumps together into large floating mats. Great idea, but he sort of just discards it. And I'm like, wait a second. Don't just have this idea and then discard it, because somebody in 36 years would have already thought of this. Because everyone seems really passive. They're all like, oh, the sea is rising. Oh, but it'll level off. Oh, the sea is rising, but it won't get any worse. Oh, the sea is rising. Oh, we just need to move inland. Oh, the sea is rising. And when it gets like the sea has risen 100 meters, all the governments are going, oh, no, the sea will, it'll calm down. The sea will stop rising too quickly. And even when it starts rising exponentially, like demonstrably exponentially, that all the governments are just like, oh, no, we just need to move inland. And like that. So nobody is ever doing anything. And there were a few people doing something. Of course, the rich billionaires are doing something, and some of the governments are doing things. But we've got an entire world's population. Not everyone is completely passive. Like, for example, if I was going to do this, I would come up with different ways to survive the flood. I don't want to go into them now. But, like, everyone's got all these different inventions and these different ideas. And, like, you know, large floating mats is one way to do it. You know, coming up with some, like, flexible polystyrene. I'm sure there's lots of different ways that you could do it and just make, you know, layer it and layer it and layer it. If you actually go, right, we're gonna do this right. Like, for example, my ex-girlfriend worked for a company which builds Formula One racetracks, and they built the Formula One racetrack in Shanghai. And they were telling me the stories, you know, the guys are telling me the stories. They go, right, we've got to build it, but it's really marshy land. So what they did, because they could pretty much spend whatever money they wanted it, and they had to build a racetrack underneath the racetrack in Shanghai. They actually bought up like masses of like four polystyrene factories' outputs worth of polystyrene and made polystyrene foundations for the entire racetrack in Shanghai. You can't do that for normal roads, because normal roads are actually, you know, they're going to have more than just a few races, you know, and the cars that drive around on, like, trucks drive on normal roads, you can't have foundations made out of polystyrene. But for a racetrack, which is just, you know, lightweight race cars going around there and generally not a lot of use compared to normal roads, polystyrene foundation on marshy land for a racetrack, yeah, go for it. So that's what they did. Now, just imagine the same kind of thing, polystyrene foundation for houses, build your houses, polystyrene foundations, and there you go. Now, this is technology that already exists. Like, if the sea level was really rising as it was doing in this book, we could just say, right, what we need to do, we need to turn over the entire, you know, entire industrial output to polystyrene, okay? Forget, you know, using all this fuel and using all this plastic to build, you know, packaging and stuff like that. And actually, any packaging, once it's done, we can just feed it in, recycle all the plastic and make polystyrene. That would be my thing. And of course, that kind of idea is never mentioned in this book. Now, that's just one idea that I've had. Stephen Baxter, because he misses it completely, loses respect for me for trying to take on this massive, wide, world-spanning thing when he's not as clever as the entire population. He's very clever, probably more clever than me. in many ways, you know, he's like a, you know, what did I say he was before? Mathematician, engineer or something like that. I'm not a mathematician and engineer. However, I know somebody who works for a company and I chatted with them and I worked out what they did to stop a Formula One racetrack, you know, and I didn't even think of that when reading the book. I just thought of it now as just off the top of my head, that kind of thing. So you can work on hydroponics to make, you know, sure, you know, agriculture works, and aquaculture as well, fish farming, establish factories that, you know, extract minerals from the sea. Again, that's mentioned, but then sort of discarded in the book as well. And you can maybe send stuff into space, you know, catch asteroids and then deliver raw materials. Because, you know, mining, if the sea is you know, mining at the bottom of the sea is difficult. So maybe it'd be better to capture asteroids and deliver raw materials down to the surface. Maybe you could infuse the raw materials with like vacuums inside of it, like bubbles of vacuum inside the metal or the, you know, aluminium that you're delivering from the moon. And then when it hits the water, it'll float because it's got all these like vacuum bubbles in it as well, which are of course less dense than water. So you could actually make metal that floats. So you could drop down floating platforms of raw materials onto the Earth's, into the water. Anyway, again, I'm just making shit up here. The entire population of the world could just make up these ideas and maybe go for it, but you don't have that kind of stuff. So that's why good disaster stories are told from restricted points of view, because you can actually say, right, these are these people's qualifications, these are what they've got, these are the resources that they've got in hand, and now they're going to have to survive. If it was this book, and it's like, okay, here's this group of five hostages, and instead of going off to work for billionaires who can do anything they want and then build the Queen Mary again, what the hell? They just have to survive, and it's just their trek, and what it's going to do, they're going to be at the coast in Barcelona, sea level, and then by the end of the book, they're going to be the last people on the top of Mount Everest or something like that. That would have been a story. It would have been not just a metaphorical climb, it would have been a literal climb from the lowest point of Earth to the highest point of Earth, telling the story all the way. Actually, there was a really nice touch at the end of this book where they get introduced to Sherpa idea, and as they're watching the top of Mount Everest disappear under the sea, he's like, well, there I am, I'm a Sherpa, that was the last mountain gone. And he's like the only person who can really identify, except for like mountain climbers, but that was his life, walking up mountains, and now there's no more mountains, and the mountains were the last thing to disappear. So his was a very poignant moment, even though it was a really late introduced character, and it was a bit like, why are they introducing this character at this point of the book? And then I realized, oh, he just wanted to have the Sherpa moment when Everest, you know, in the last chapter. Maybe, I don't know, it's a bit weird. Anyway, so that's why you need it restricted. Narrow the focus, and you can outthink your audience, you can outthink your readers. Widen the focus, and there'll be people that know more than you. For example, I'm on a cruise ship. I know, like, this is the really stupid thing. Okay, here's another bit of a rant here about this book. So, at one point, he says, right, we're going to rebuild... No, this is his main character, and he rebuilds the Queen Mary, which is, like, was built in the, like, 1930s or something. You know, it was used as a troop ship and all these different stuff like that. You know, great ship. A lot of history there. You know, very good ship for its time. And he says this was the pinnacle of, you know, cruise ship engineering. No, it wasn't. It was the biggest one ever. No, it wasn't. You know, but he was going, oh yeah, and it'll be a symbol in the future, the Queen Mary, we're going to rebuild it, it's going to have like a nuclear power station, it's going to do this, and it's going to do that, and it's going to do this. And he says all the other ocean liners are rusted away, and this is going to be a beacon of hope in the world. And I'm like, all the other ocean liners are rusted away. I think that was the line he said, you know, rusted away, ran out of fuel, and that's it. And I'm thinking, wait a second, first of all, Mr. Baxter, do you know how many ocean liners exist today in 2010? Oh no, 2008, when this book was written. How many ocean liners do you think there are? You know, an ocean liner comparable with the Queen Mary. There is exactly one ocean liner, passenger ocean liner in existence today. It's called the Queen Mary II. It's actually named after the Queen Mary that you're writing about in this book. And it's the biggest you know, cruise liner ever built, and it's the fastest one. It can go backwards faster than most cruise ships these days can go going forward. So if you're talking about ocean liners, talk about ocean liners. And if you're doing that, there's one at the moment. There's another one, actually. There's the Queen Elizabeth II, the QE2, which is actually parked up in Dubai. You know, I've worked on both of these ships because that's what I do. I work a lot on cruise ships. I spend a lot of time at sea. And, you know, there's a reason why there's no more ocean liners is because ocean liners were built for speed, that to do an Atlantic crossing from Europe to New York, you know, Southampton or France or something to New York in a week, and then back again the next week, and then back again the next week. And we don't need that anymore. But the Queen Mary still does like these week-long crossings backwards and forwards. So if you actually want to travel as a passenger by sea from, say, London to New York, you do it on the Queen Mary too. But there's not a lot of there's not enough demand to actually, you know, there's not lots of immigrants going one way and back again, and, you know, stars going backwards and forwards and stuff, and because, you know, you just fly nowadays and stuff like that. However, there's hundreds of cruise ships, and they're all built for staying at sea for a long time. So they're not built for speed or for, you know, they're built for providing a home for lots of people for long periods of time and stuff like that. And they're not big. They're, you know, I mean, they are big. They're bigger than the Queen Mary too. They're bigger than the Queen Mary by far as well. If you want to have a ship, buy the Queen Mary too. Buy any of these big cruise ships. Buy the new big one, which is the Oasis of the Seas. It's way bigger than the Queen Mary too. It's one of the biggest ships ever. Certainly the biggest, you know, passenger ship ever. But the Queen Mary too is a really good candidate for the exact job. He's a billionaire. He could have just bought the Queen Mary too. And I think he's really underestimating what ships are like and how big they are and how many are there. You know what the largest, you know, the biggest industry, the biggest service industry is in the world today? It's shipping. It's moving things from one place to the other. You know, I'm at sea all the time, and it just amazes me how big ships are and how many there are. There's just thousands, millions of massive ships all over the world, going all over the place, and they last more than 36 years as well. The ships that are being built now, 36 years' time, I mean, they'd probably be out of service, and broken down and you know, and recycled mostly, you know, and you know, they reuse a lot of the you know, the steel and stuff on these ships, and then, you know, resmelt it and build new ships and stuff. But if there was no more shipyards, these ships would still be there. And yet at the end of the book, everyone's floating around on rafts, and I'm thinking, wait a second, there's like how many thousand cruise ships are there? There's probably maybe, you know, there's probably a few hundred big cruise ships of the, you know, the size of the Queen Mary too, all of them just ignored by the end of the ship. On top of that, there's probably hundreds of oil tankers, way bigger than any cruise ship at the moment, all of them, you know, ignored. There's probably thousands of container ships, all as big as any cruise ship are at the moment, you know, more ruggedly built and stuff like that, and, you know, probably 1,000 bulk carriers and stuff. This is what makes the world turn, literally. This is what keeps the world afloat, ba-bum. This is what, you know, powers industry. This is what powers the world at the moment, is shipping. And you can't write a book about a ship and a flood and an ark and do that and just say, oh, you know, when, you know, in 30 years time, it'll all be rafts. It's like, no, one, it'll be rafts. It'll be, you know, human ingenuity will win through. And if it doesn't, you know, just that, you know, probability that some of these ships won't sink by 30 years time, because they won't, you know, most of them will probably survive. You know, and just go like that. Anyone with any kind of knowledge at life at sea, or anything about boats, or anything about cruise ships, or anything about ocean liners, or anything about shipping, or anything like that, just pick out a million flaws in this book. Again, I try not to think about that too much, but it just comes back. It just keeps punching me in the face all the time. Anyway, the structure of the story. Oh man, this is kind of going to turn out to be like my longest review ever. I'm going to see if I can get through some of these points. So, the structure of this story as well, after I've talked about this science and different stuff like that, I'll skip that later on. So the structure is very quite redundant. It's like the sea rises, influx of refugees, and then so the refugees go higher, and then it's pretty much rinse and repeat over and over. Rinse, literally rinse and repeat. They get themselves dry, and then they do that again. It's a constant iteration of new cities going underwater. It's great. It just took a long time. And in the end, like I said before, no real stories. I'm just going through these notes quickly here. Like they say, there's no narrative arc, there's no journey that anyone goes on that unifies the whole thing as well. Oh, I mentioned that point earlier on. Oh, that's good. I can skip through a few of these points here. Yeah, it picked up a bit towards the second half of the book, but and some of the scenes at the end of the book were pretty much worth reading, but you might as well just read Earth Abides instead of this. Oh yeah, and also the last line of the book, literally the last words of the book is like, check out the sequel, guys! And I'm like, oh, for goodness sake. It's literally is like, it's a really poignant ending, and then they suddenly go, what is the arc? And they're like, this is the arc, and it's suddenly like, hope you've enjoyed this book from Audible. You can read the next book called Ark. And I'm like, like this. Anyway, moving on to probably the worst part of the book, if the stuff that I've read, talked about already isn't bad, is the characters, actually. It's like these robotic monsters, like completely lacking in any kind of warmth or compassion. It's horrific, literally. And these are the lead characters. And I don't want to talk about some of the characters because they really are horrific. But let's talk about Lily, who is the main character. She's a complete non-character, but she just surrounds herself by, like, nasty, evil people, and just doesn't seem to care about it. Like, her own sister wants her daughter. So, like, she's going, okay, sister, My daughter, I want my daughter to have a late term abortion. It's 7 months. She's 7 months gone. I want her to have an abortion because she's got pregnant with a boyfriend and I don't approve of the boy and they haven't got married yet. And it's like, whoa. And I'm just like, whoa, wait a second. Anything that this boyfriend is like, anything about this whole stuff that you, just that the fact that you said you should have a 7 month abortion. Now, I'm not, like, personally, my own political views, I'm not, like, a pro-life or anything like that, but to tell your daughter that when she's in this loving relationship, to have an abortion at 7 months, it's like, that's horrific. I mean, especially because one of the friends of this main character, one of the people that she's being looked after is a rape baby, and they're trying to look at, and just to say, oh, yeah, oh, no, you should have, it's just like, it was just terrible. And I'm like, you wait a second, you're the main character, I want to identify with you, say something, do something about this. You have to say them and say, no. And then later on, someone just shoots someone directly in the face. Like, actually, it's the same boyfriend. It's just a bang in the face and feels good about it. And the main character says that they feel good about it. And she just gets on with them fine. And she's fine about it. Yeah, I'll just hang out with you. Yeah, I'll still do work with you. And I'm like, get away from these people. This is terrible. And then there's this, like, it, you know, and then there's this one character who makes this biological weapon that it targets by ethnicity and uses it. And Lily is like, oh, yeah, I'll just hang out with you. You're great. I'm just like, get away from these people. These people are evil and murderous and terrible. And this billionaire is just, he's just horrific. And it's like, yeah, if you want to tell the story of horrific people, great. But don't put your main character in among all these people and just gets on fine with them. And for like no reason at all, it's just like, get away from these people. You're intelligent enough. You're a helicopter pilot. You can go and work anywhere. Anywhere there's a helicopter, you can probably go and get a job, do stuff, you know, work on all these other projects. Don't work with these monstrous people. Get away from your sister. Get away from these other people who are just bad. And there's this one character called Gary, who's another one of these refugees. Not refugees. Well, he is a refugee at one point, but he's also one of these hostage, ex-hostage people. And I liked him because even though it was a bit weird how he sort of just faded in and out of the picture enough, he was always going his own way and trying to lead people on his own way. And he was never compromising whenever he got anywhere. And he was always on the right side. And I was like, tell Gary's story. He walked like continents and he led people and he was doing stuff and he was proactive. And even though his, you know, what he was doing was ultimately doomed, it was like a heroic, tragic story. And his, you know, but then at the end of the book, he's just like, and I'm like, get away from these monstrous people doing useless things and get to these more heroic people doing equally useless things. But it's heroic because it's tragic because they're going out their way to do good and to help people and do all this kind of stuff. And it was, you know, and then you get, like, say, this Nathan Lanixon, who's this billionaire. It's always handy. This is what always annoys me about this kind of book. It's like these disaster books. It's always really handy to have a billionaire who just goes, yes, and I'm going to solve the world's problems. And I'm like, great. I mean, I know people do exist like that. We do have them, like people like, you know, Bill Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, who are like, we're going to wipe out malaria. And you're like, that's awesome. And but then you go, oh, I'm going to be a billionaire and I'm going to build the Queen Mary cruise ship and then sail it around the world. And you're like, what? That's your plan? And I'm like, okay, if you're a billionaire, you must have some kind of business sense to be able to make your money somehow. And then if you've got that business sense of making money, surely you've got the sense to spend it wisely. You know, like, if there was this flood, I reckon Bill and Melinda Gates and, you know, all these other people, you know, Warren Buffett, who, you know, famously just gave all his money away. And these people are like, oh, shit, right. Oh, okay, forget about malaria. No, well, we can probably forget about malaria because, the you know, the whole water snail, you know, life cycle, it's probably going to work itself out. We're going to have other diseases to worry about. Let's build an ark. Let's build a big flood. You know, it's that kind of thing. And also, every interaction between any two characters in the entire book is completely unbelievable. Completely, it's painful to read as well. Anyway, moving on. The science. Oh, I pretty much talked about that. It's terrible. Like I said at the beginning, I mentioned big problems with this. It's called hard science fiction. There's nothing hard about this. It's just very floppy. Yeah, there's some passages. I made a note of this on my iPhone as I was listening to it. It said, "Dew gathered on the cold glass." And I was like, dew. Do you know what dew is? Dew doesn't gather on glasses. Condensation gathers on the glasses. Dew doesn't gather on glass. Dew gathers on grass. And I'm just like, it's like these little things in the book where, you know, when you get to that point and you're just like, wait a second. Dew is one thing. It is condensation, but it's not condensation anyway. It's just these little things. Oh, and also geography as well. He seems to get it mixed up. At one point, the sea level has risen 70 meters, and he goes, oh, yeah, I docked my boat at Coney Island. And I'm like, wait a second. I was just in Coney Island a few months ago. Coney Island is an island at sea. It's like 2 meters high at its higher point, maybe 3 meters high at its highest point. It's like, you don't dock your boat down at Coney Island when the sea is 70 meters high. You know, everything on Coney Island is underwater. The, you know, the swinging, the cyclone, you know, roller coaster is now just broken up into bits of wood and is floating away. Yeah, and also he talks about a bit about, it's a bit weird that some of the geography he seems to, you know, talk about, and I'm just thinking every time that he mentioned geography outside of, say, London, because I think he's a British author. Let me just check here on Wikipedia. Yeah, British. So, of course, maybe he got the geography in the UK correct, but it's like, has he been to Washington Park? No, what was it called, in the small park with the in New York? Yeah, Washington Park Square, whatever it's called. It's like, hey, there's thousands of people there. It's like, the park's not that big. He's like, oh yeah, everyone down from Soho and Chinatown has come up here. And it's like, no, there's a reason why these parks in New York are really, really small. It's because there's too many people there and people don't fit into that big space. So that's why they have skyscrapers and massive apartment blocks, because people don't fit into that kind of space. Anyway, all this kind of thing. Bring on to the writing. Yeah, writing's all over the place. It's quite pedestrian. I don't mind simple writing in a story, as long as the story is engaging. But when it's just the same thing over and over again and the characters are like, ugh, and the science is, ugh, stuff like that. And at one point, everything is always sea rise in meters and sea rise in meters. And then right near the end of the book, actually quite a cool section where they're going around in this book, they say, yes, and the sea is this many feet, oh no, the land is this many feet below their boat. And I'm like, why isn't it feet? I don't know what feet are, you know, after talking meters all the way through, suddenly it switches. I'm like, a copy editor could probably have picked that out. And also a bit thing that I dislike about the chapters is that they're very, very short, and they're what I like to call had chapters, or the beginnings of the chapters that had. And I've talked about this in about books before. When I say had, it's sort of like he had done this in the past, and it there was actually less. I don't think there was any actually time where he actually wrote had, but the way it works is this. Person A meets person B. 5 years have skipped since the last time that we've met these people. They spend 95% of the chapter catching up on what they've done, sometimes by talking to each other. What have you done? Oh, I've been here and here and here. And then it goes into like the more the third person stuff, and they're going, oh yes, and this is what's been happening around the world, and this is what's going to happen around, this is what's been happening around the world. And then they have a single argument, and then something happens in the next chapter. And it's always like this. It always, here's the chapter, it's 2 years in the future, we'll fill you in on all the cities that have drowned since then, and all the countries that have disappeared, all the political stuff that's going on, and all the different things that have failed, and stuff like this. Here are the two characters, let me tell you the story, this is what's happened. So it's, the entire book is written in past tense, like continuous past tense of like two people meeting each other, telling about what's happening, doing one thing, and then it moving on as well. And also they had these scrapbook chapters, which is a bit weird. It's all like, yeah, extract from this chapter, this is what's happening here. And then they go back to the characters as well. And it's told from this sort of like floating point of view. Oh, floating. But that wasn't even an intentional pun there. And then at one point someone actually reads this scrapbook and said, Christy, it's the daughter, it's one of the characters in the book, keeps this scrapbook on her little iPad thing. And at one point at the end of the book, another character reads it and it's like, oh, it's so poignant. And it was very well written. She could have been a journalist. And I was like, no, she couldn't. Those those passengers were no way written good enough to be a professional journalist. Unfortunately, that's pretty much indicative of the whole book. None of this book is written by someone who is a good enough a writer to be a journalist as well. You know, these bits that go, oh yes, the US team was favourite to be, you know, favourite for the World Cup in 2018. I'm just like, you don't say that. It's like screams, we're in the future, guys. It's like, don't just do stuff like that. I mean, if you can do it, but don't like, it can come up in conversation between two characters and it become cute. But when you actually suddenly say, ah, the World Cup's been called off, and you're just like, ah, oh, for goodness sake. Anyway, oh, bringing on to audiobook. Oh man, we're at 50 minutes already. I didn't realize I had so much to say about this. I only got a few notes, but I seem to be talking too much here. I'm getting back into podcasting, doing the SFB. Maybe I've not done enough bad reviews for a long time. Here we go. So, audiobook issue. First of all, the chapters don't line, the chapter ends of the chapter dividers in the, you know, in the actual M4A format stuff, from they don't match up with the end of the chapters in the book. So when you skip forward to the next chapter, it starts like two lines in or a minute in and stuff like that. Not a big issue, but a little bit annoying. And also in chapter 15, they repeated a line twice. Normally, I don't bother with that kind of stuff, but there it was. Anyway, Chris Patton, I think his name was, the narration. I think I've got the name right. Terrible, terrible narrator. One of the worst ever. He's just not very good at reading, for a start. He mispronounces lots of names. Pronunciation. Sometimes I can think, well, he's American and it's a book written in English, so maybe he doesn't know the words and stuff like that. Like, there's a word called remit, and there's another a word called remit, and they mean different things. I don't want to go into it, but I think they're pronounced differently. So at least as far as I know, as a non-professional audiobook narrator, I think you pronounce remit and remit in two different ways because they actually mean different things. Anyway, then he gets on to name places, most of them pronounced incorrectly. Some of them, I guess most of them in the United States were pronounced correctly. I think you go to New York, again, I've just been there, might as well tell the story. Yeah, you go to Soho, and the reason it's called Soho is because it's south of Houston. And Houston is a street which goes across. It's the first street. Everywhere above there is, first street, second street, that kind of stuff. But that is the first non-numbered street heading south, and it's called Houston. Except it's not called Houston, it's actually called Houston. But you wouldn't know that because it's spelled the same as Houston. But it's not, it's Houston. It's that kind of thing. But when you get to the point in a book where there's loads of place names all the way across the UK, and you're a professional, there should have been someone like a producer of the audiobook saying, you know, you pronounce Suffolk, you don't pronounce the L in Suffolk, it's not Suffolk, and things like that. And Edinburgh is pronounced Edinburgh, it's a capital city of a country, it's called Edinburgh, it's not called Edinburgh. And you're actually playing the part, or you're talking about someone who lives in this country, in England. Well, actually, not in this country. I made a mistake there. I made a geographical mistake. No, they don't live in the country of Scotland, but they're British, so they should know how to pronounce Edinburgh. And there's loads of other things. Some pronunciations you get mixed up. If it's a character saying Montevideo, I would say, okay, maybe they got it wrong. Maybe they would say Montevideo, but it's not Montevideo. It's Montevideo. But when the narrator says Montevideo, you're thinking, you just really don't know very much about the world, do you? And when it's a global book, it really... Oh, I made a note of this. They said they passed over the flooded Houses of Parliament, and they said, and he sang the Big Ben melody. Bing bong, bing bong. And I'm like, wait a second, that's not it. It's bing bong, bing bong. And then it goes bing bong, bing bong. And it's like, if you're going to sing the Big Ben melody, get it right. The worst thing about the whole of this book, though, is the accents were just terrible. It's an American reader doing British accents. Now, you can, if you're just going to say, oh, this character is British, let's just have a generic British accent, I'd be like, yeah, that's fair enough. But when you say, this character is from the East End of London, Nathan Lennickson from the East End of London, and he has this weird mismatch of, badly pronounced, English words and English accent and things like that, you think, oh, okay, I don't mind that kind of stuff. But then when you mispronounce a word, for example, flood, and the way I say it is flood is quite a neutral English language, someone from the East End would sort of sound like flood, it would be more like that kind of stuff, it would be like flood. And someone from Yorkshire would say flood, but when you've got a Cockney guy saying flood, you're thinking, you're not really getting it. And I'm thinking, wait a second, why is this bothering me? Flood is the name of the book, and the guy can't pronounce the word flood correctly, and it's like one of the main characters of the book. You think, oh man, just a little bit of effort. I mean, that's why, I'm not an audiobook narrator, but why can't they get good narrators to narrate this kind of, why didn't they get a British narrator to narrate it? Because most of the main characters are British. It's written by a British author. Just get a British narrator. And it's literally like, they just thought, doesn't really matter, does it? And it's like, no, it doesn't matter to most people, but it matters to me, because every time anyone, any character opened their mouth to speak at all, it mattered, because it just took me out of the story in the same way that the bad writing and all this other kind of stuff there. Anyway, I've got to finish up quickly now. I want to see if I can do this in 3 minutes. Here we go. Themes. Inequality between rich and poor, something, something, corporation, something, something. A little bit of racism. If you really want racism, read Lucifer's Hammer. And also, if you want everyday people surviving the end of the world and stuff like that, doing things on a more human scale, Lucifer's Hammer is way better. Not fantastic. I mean, it's good, but and things like that. And if you want a good book about some of the themes that it touches on at the end of this book, read Earth Abides. Actually, I don't think I ever did an official rating of Earth Abides, because it was like an SFF audio crossover podcast kind of review, and I did a big discussion that went on too long. But that's easily a 4.5 star book, if not a 5-star book. Yeah, maybe that's maybe Earth Abides is a 5-star book. It should be. It could be. Let me put it that way. I'd have to think about it if it is. It probably is a 5-star book. And it's beautiful, and it's touching, and it's well well written, and the characters are, you know, are perfect, and they're flawed in human ways, and you really care for them in some ways and things like that. And it's a long story told over 36 years more or something like that. But it's done right. It's disastrous done right. Or if you want other disaster books, read The Day of the Triffids. There's loads more stuff of, you know, people encroaching in different... The Crake and Wakes, another book by John Wyndham, which I've got at home. I should read it again. It's in the omnibus. And there's also flooding. Spoilers. There's also flooding in that book as well. I should read it when I get home. Other disaster books. Let me see. I've got the Wikipedia page open. Flood. Let me see if... Stephen Baxter. Read Moonseed. That's like End of the World. Way better than this book. Yeah, read Moonseed. So lots of the same kind of themes and ideas touched on. Oh, I've lost my notes. What? I flicked across to Wikipedia. I've lost my. Here it is. This is what I did. I just looked at the top of my notes again. So if you want to read, this is what I was going to say. I set this joke up at the beginning when I thought of it. If you want to read a disaster story, read this book because it's a disaster. Ba-dum-tsh. Been waiting to say that whole review. Although, again, probably someone on Amazon has used that one line as the sort of, you know, pithy title of their one-star review of this book. Anyway, I'm going to give it 1.5 stars because I did get through to the end. It really isn't as bad as some books. Maybe the worst book I've read this year. Maybe not. Actually, I don't know. I'd have to look into that as well. I really wish I'd just read The Timeships instead. I might even just get The Timeships on audiobook if I don't have time to read it when I get home. But because that book must have had an editor, because it's one of his first stories. Stephen Baxter, it's one of his earlier novels, isn't it? So they must have had, like, a copy editor, an other kind of editor to say, no, look, this is just shit. Go back and rewrite it again. And all these characters that we all hate and stuff, put in some characters that we actually like. And Gary, make Gary the main character. And the people, and you know, when Gary meets someone who, like, he used to know really well, maybe it'd be better that he didn't find out that she was a lesbian, like, after knowing her for 5 years, because, you know, it'll bring a little bit more human touch if he actually knows the sexuality of his closest friends, like, a little bit earlier than halfway through the book. It makes them more human when characters who know each other actually know each other and actually care about each other. All these little points, you know, that you can make, you know, things, you know, a little bit more human, that kind of thing. Rather than this tosh, take it away, rewrite it, come back in a year's time and actually reread. But of course, Stephen Baxter's at the point where he doesn't need to do that. So I'm actually thinking of, like, I just need to go back. I think, you know, I really enjoyed reading Stephen Baxter's other books, you know, like Ring and Flux and those other books as well. And some of his one-off books. Like I say, Moonseed, pretty good book. Much better than this, like I say. And there's some other ones. Oh, yeah, like, he does the Manifold trilogy as well, with the time and the space and the other... It's all about the Fermi paradox. Actually, just a lot more ambitious than this book and better told. And, you know, of course, the characters are never great in Stephen Baxter's books, but, yeah, I could just do better. Anyway, that'll do. Next book that I'm going to read, probably... I've got The Hunger Games on my iPod, and I've got some other... What else have I got as audiobook on iPod? Let me look it up here. I have World War Z... I'm not going to finish that at all. Oh, Terminal World by Alistair Reynolds. And I'm definitely going to... Loads of people are saying, hey, you should really read the latest Ian M. Banks books. It's a culture novel. He's back on form with a book called... I can't remember. But it's pretty good. Something folding... thingy... Surface Detail. Surface Detail is what it's called. So I'm probably going to buy that. Maybe an audiobook. Maybe I'll see if I can find it in a bookshop as well. Probably wait for it to come out in paperback, though. So I'll get onto that, too. So that's it. Thank you very much for listening to this review. It's been long, and hopefully I can do... it's been interesting, too. Maybe I've been ranting too much. But to be honest, I've had a lot of fun today. Maybe not as fun as visiting Sardinia for the first time and going to see some interesting caves that I found on Wiki Travel and stuff like that. But I've had a good hour doing this. In fact, it's one of those times where actually ranting about the book can actually be more interesting than reading the book. And that, to be honest, if it was slightly better, I'd probably just not finish reading it. But because it was so bad in so many ways, it's like, as you're reading it, it's like a game going, like, oh, man, this is going to be so fun to rant about. And I'm sort of in my head, I'm going, this is so bad. It's like, why are they doing this? It's like, these characters are horrific. How can they do it? It's like, wait, there must be some kind of redemption coming from this character at some point in the book. Yeah, anyway. Wow, 1 hour and 3 minutes. I just flicked back to Audacity here. Right, thanks a lot for listening. Email me, luke@juggler.net. You can follow my blog, lukeburge.com/blog. You can read my novels as well, which are way better than this. You know, I'm not trying to be big-headed or anything, but it's not hard to write better fiction than this. You can find that at lukeburge.com. Links on the front page. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @lukeburge on Twitter. And the best thing you can do is follow me on goodreads.com. And become my friend on goodreads.com, because then I can keep up with your reading as well. I always check through and see what people are reading. I've got the flood page here. Let me scroll down. Patrick marked it as to read. Patrick, unmark this book for to read. Chris rated it 5 stars. Chris, what are you thinking? Lewis marked it to read. Ken is currently reading it, although his last update was 30th of July, 2009. Yeah, so there's probably a reason why he only got 35 pages and then stopped. Tom Rowe rated it 5 stars. What are you doing, Tom? How can you... On a level with Earth Abides for End of the World Fiction. What are you talking about? I listen to this as an audiobook read by Chris Patton. Patton does an excellent job, although he does mispronounce a few words. A few words, yeah. His accents are great. Anyway, maybe me and Tom Rowe are going to disagree. Tom, email me this if you're still listening. maybe not. Anyway, again, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.